Most people believe the justice system protects the innocent. But what happens when lies are weaponized and the truth is buried under social outrage? In a small college town, where a promising student athlete was poised to go pro, a single accusation shattered everything. She said he raped her. No one questioned it. The university suspended him. Sponsors dropped him. His face was splashed across every news outlet as another predator exposed. But here's the twist. He didn't do it. And she knew it. This wasn't about justice. It was revenge. As cracks began to form in her story, the pressure to maintain the lie grew unbearable. But instead of backing down, she crafted an even more sinister narrative. One that pulled in new victims, planted evidence, and almost sent an innocent man to prison for life. This isn't just about one false allegation. It's about how a lie, once told in the right climate, can become truth. And how those who dare to question it risk everything. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Accusation. Ethan Cross wasn't just another college athlete. He was the name on Mercer Valley's football field. Explosive talent, near-perfect GPA, and a clean reputation that made him the pride of both the school and his struggling Detroit neighborhood. Scouts were watching. His coach said he was a first-round pick if he kept it together through senior year, and Ethan always did. He kept his circle small, no parties, no drama, except one. Her name was Alina Westbrook. She was beautiful, magnetic, and smarter than most people gave her credit for. A psychology major with a taste for dominance, Alina liked control, especially over people who thought they were beyond it. Ethan was her biggest challenge. She pursued him with relentless charm, wrapped him in compliments, offered just enough vulnerability to keep him close. For a while it worked, but Ethan eventually saw through it. The constant manipulation, the emotional games, her jealousy if he so much as helped a girl lift weights at the campus gym. After 3 months, he ended it. That's when his life ended too. The next morning, campus security knocked on Ethan's door. They told him to pack a bag. He was being removed from campus. Alina had filed a report claiming he raped her after a party in his dorm 2 nights prior. Ethan thought it was a misunderstanding, a mistake. It wasn't. By sundown, the school had emailed the entire student body, announcing Ethan's suspension pending Title IX investigation. His name trended on local Twitter feeds. Posts labeled him a predator. Protest flyers read, "Believe survivors, expel rapists." He hadn't even seen the official report yet. Alina told investigators that Ethan forced her into sex, despite her saying no multiple times. She claimed she left crying, went straight to her friend Tessa's place, and spent the night there, unable to process the trauma. Ethan was blindsided. He pulled up text messages from the night in question. Alina had texted, "On my way at 9:04 p.m. They'd exchanged flirty jokes. She'd asked if he had snacks. She stayed until 2 a.m. No one screamed. No one cried. But Alina had deleted her side of the texts, and Tessa backed her story. That week, Ethan lost everything. His scholarship was suspended. His campus job was terminated. NFL scouts went silent. Reporters camped outside his mom's house. Even his best friend, Jaden, stopped answering calls. "I don't know, man," Jaden muttered when Ethan finally reached him. "This is serious. People are saying some crazy stuff." The university fast-tracked the Title IX hearing. Campus activists demanded expulsion, calling Ethan the next Brock Turner. Alina was invited to speak at a Take Back the Night rally, where she gave a tearful, shaky-voiced speech about surviving campus assault. She never said his name, but she didn't have to. Everyone already knew. Ethan's mother, Janine, was the only one who refused to let him drown. A hospital nurse who worked double shifts for decades, she took out a second mortgage and hired defense attorney Miles Greer, a sharp but notoriously cold litigator known for defending the accused in high-profile campus cases. Greer was skeptical at first. "Do not lie to me," he warned during their first meeting. "If you so much as touched her without consent, I walk." Ethan slid his phone across the table. "I didn't rape her. I didn't touch her any differently than I ever had. She wanted to be there. Greer nodded slowly. Then we burn this lie to the ground. But he knew it wouldn't be easy. In the court of public opinion, especially on college campuses, due process was often a dirty word. You're already guilty, Greer said. The question is, can we prove she's lying before they bury you? Then came the first crack. Greer subpoenaed the security footage from the residence hall entrance. It showed Alina entering the dorm building at 9:15 p.m., smiling and laughing with Ethan. She wasn't limping. She wasn't crying. She even kissed him on the cheek in the elevator. The footage showed her leaving at 2:12 a.m., alone, unhurried. But when the evidence was submitted to the Title IX panel, the school pushed back. We believe trauma presents in various ways, the chair said. A survivor's behavior doesn't have to match expectations. Greer was livid. So, video proof she was fine means nothing? The panel refused to allow the footage into the final hearing. It could bias the decision, they said. Still, Greer pressed on. He interviewed Ethan's suitemates. No one heard anything that night. No yelling. No struggle. One student, Eric Hahn, recalled hearing music playing faintly and assumed Ethan was just hooking up, but Alina claimed she screamed for help. When Greer requested Alina's full phone records, the school denied access. Privacy concerns. He asked to speak to Tessa. She declined. The university warned Greer not to intimidate witnesses. Everything felt stacked against them. Greer leaned back in his chair and sighed. They don't want truth. They want a clean narrative. Ethan looked hollow. So what do I do? You hold the line, Greer said. Because people like her, if she's lying, they don't stop when they're caught. They double down. And he was right. Because what Alina did next would make the original accusation look almost tame. She wasn't just trying to ruin Ethan anymore. She was trying to destroy anyone who dared defend him. Chapter 2. The scheme unfolds. Ethan Cross didn't sleep the night the Title IX board dismissed the security footage. He sat in his childhood bedroom, the walls still covered in high school trophies, as if mocking him with who he used to be. Online, people called him a monster. Strangers DM'd him threats. His future was slipping through his fingers, and no one seemed to care, except Greer. The attorney launched his own investigation, pulling public records, combing through social media, and looking for any threads that could unravel Alina's story. One question haunted him. Why lie? What was Alina's endgame? Then it clicked. Greer found texts Ethan had overlooked, ones from the days before their breakup. Alina was spiraling. Don't throw this away, she wrote. I'm the best thing that ever happened to you. The tone was desperate, aggressive. She threatened to tell the dean Ethan had cheated on an exam, anything to make him hurt like she was. A pattern emerged. Alina wasn't just reacting, she was planning. Then came the second accusation. 2 days before Ethan's scheduled Title IX hearing, Alina filed a police report claiming he broke into her apartment and left threatening messages. She had scratches on her arms, tear-streaked photos, a voicemail that said, "Drop the charges, or next time it won't be just a warning." The university shut the hearing down. Ethan was declared a risk to the community. Formal expulsion proceedings began. But Greer wasn't backing down. He had his own bombshell. He'd tracked the burner phone that left the voicemail. Surveillance footage from a nearby electronics store showed a woman, same height, same platinum blonde hair, buying it in cash the day before the voicemail was sent. She wore a hoodie, sunglasses, but the timestamp lined up perfectly with Alina's class break. He submitted the footage. The police said the video wasn't clear enough for a positive ID. The university said it was inadmissible third-party evidence. It didn't matter that Ethan was 30 miles away at a football rehab center when the voicemail was made. The accusation alone was enough to cement the narrative. And then, Alina made her boldest move yet. She accused Miles Greer, Ethan's attorney, of coercion and intimidation. During a press conference hosted by her new legal team, Alina claimed Greer had threatened her with exposure and harassment if she didn't recant. She said he sent private investigators to her job, called her friends, and made her feel hunted. I just want to be safe, she sobbed, cameras flashing. I want my Voice to matter. The public went wild. Protesters surrounded Greer's office. Ethan's case became radioactive. Law firms refused to assist. Reporters began digging into Greer's past, looking for dirt. But behind the scenes, a new player had entered the game. Reed Mathers, an independent journalist with a reputation for peeling back carefully constructed lies. His true crime podcast, Guilty Until Proven Male, had exploded in popularity for exposing wrongful accusations and media bias. Reed watched the press conference. Something didn't add up. He made a call. His first breakthrough came from Alina's old university, one she had left abruptly before transferring to Mercer Valley. A former roommate, who requested anonymity, told Reed, "She did this before, not rape, but she threatened a guy, said if he didn't stay with her, she'd ruin his life." The man, Noah Singer, was a sophomore business student. Reed found him in Portland working a warehouse job. "She lied about everything," Noah said. "I caught her snooping through my email, deleting messages from girls. When I tried to leave, she claimed I hit her. School investigated. No charges, but I lost my RA job. People stopped talking to me. I left after that. She'd done it before, and no one stopped her." Reed quietly reached out to Greer and offered his findings. The two began sharing notes. Alina was unraveling. She'd taken a leave of absence from classes. She moved into a new apartment under a different name. But then came a surprise twist. Tessa, the friend who had backed her story, suddenly deactivated all her social media accounts. Then she disappeared from campus. Reed tracked her to a motel two towns over and paid her a visit. She answered the door, visibly anxious. "You don't know what she's capable of," Tessa whispered. "I didn't lie to help her. I lied because she threatened to out me." "Out you?" Reed asked. "She knew I was seeing a professor, said if I didn't back her up, she'd report me. And she had pictures." "I panicked." Reed recorded the interview. That night, he edited episode one of his new series, The Fake Rape Plot. The episode went live at 7 a.m. By 10 a.m., it had 40,000 downloads. By lunch, Alina deleted her Instagram. By sunset, a lawyer for Ethan filed a defamation and malicious prosecution suit. The tide had shifted, but no one was prepared for what happened next. 2 days later, Alina staged one final stunt. She walked into a police station, claiming she'd been attacked again. Her face was bruised, her dress torn. She named Ethan's teammate, Malik Jones, as the attacker, insisting he assaulted her on Ethan's behalf. Except Malik had an ironclad alibi. He was live streaming a Call of Duty tournament the entire night. The bruises. Fake. Makeup residue remained on the towel she used to clean up. That lie broke the dam. Police issued a warrant for Alina's arrest on charges of filing a false report, obstruction, and evidence tampering. They searched her apartment and found the hoodie from the burner phone video. Burner phones. Notes. Even rehearsed scripts she'd used to coach Tessa. The case was now criminal. But Ethan didn't celebrate. He sat quietly in the back of Greer's office, staring out the window. "They'll never forget my name," he whispered. "Not for football. Not for grades. Just this." Greer nodded. "But they'll know the truth now." "And her?" Ethan asked. "That's the thing about liars," Greer said. "They always think they're in control, until reality drags them under." Chapter 3. Truth, Blood, and Consequences. The arrest was quiet. Alina Westbrook didn't scream. She didn't cry. When officers knocked on her apartment door at 6:43 a.m., she answered calmly, already dressed, as if she had expected it. They read her rights. She said nothing. The once confident campus advocate was now shackled in silence, her eyes blank. The media, however, was not so quiet. By noon, the headlines had changed. False accusation unravels. Mercer Valley. Student arrested. New podcast reveals disturbing truth behind campus scandal. Athlete cleared after months of public outrage. But for Ethan Cross, there was no vindication, only emptiness. He'd missed the combine. His draft eligibility expired. Coaches stopped calling. Some still believed he got off on a technicality. Others just didn't want the press. "Guilt clings like smoke," Greer had said. Even after the fire's out, the civil lawsuit moved forward. Ethan's defamation case against Alina made national headlines. Depositions revealed damning details, emails where she coordinated her timeline, notes coaching Tessa on what to say, screenshots of burner phone purchases, a diary entry that read, "He took my power, I'll take his life." Public sentiment swung hard. Activists who once rallied around Alina now called her a disgrace. Victim advocacy groups condemned her for damaging real survivors' credibility. But Ethan didn't care about any of that. He wanted one thing, for her to look him in the eyes and say it. That day came in court. During a hearing to determine damages, Alina was required to attend in person. She sat across from Ethan, pale, hair tied back, dressed in grey prison-issue clothes. Her once fiery demeanor had vanished. She looked older, smaller. The judge asked if she had anything to say. She stood. For a moment, it seemed like she might apologize. Her lip trembled, her eyes welled. Then she said, "I still believe what I did was right." Gasps echoed through the courtroom. Greer didn't blink. "Let the record show," he said. "She stands by the lie." Ethan leaned over and whispered, "She'll never admit it." "Doesn't have to," Greer replied. "Everyone sees her now." Outside the courthouse, reporters swarmed. Cameras rolled. Ethan, flanked by Greer and his mother, stopped at the top of the steps. "I didn't come here to gloat," he said. "I came to survive." He held up a crumpled photo, his high school team, championship night. "She didn't just take my future. She took my name, my peace, my belief in fairness. And for months, no one asked if I was telling the truth. Not the school, not the media, not even most of my friends." He paused. "But someone did." He turned to Reed Mathers, standing in the crowd with a mic. "Without him, I'd be in a cell right now, or worse." Reed's podcast, The Fake Rape Plot, exploded. Downloads crossed 10 million. The final episode, The Lie That Almost Killed Me, featured Ethan in his own voice. Calm, clear, devastating. Clips trended for weeks. "She cried louder so they believed her. I stayed quiet so they didn't believe me. No one asked what she stood to gain, only what I stood to lose. Innocent until proven guilty? Not if you're male. Not if you're black. Not if you're both." Schools across the country began revisiting their Title IX protocols. Some started adding third-party oversight. Others introduced anonymous panels. But the change came slowly, resisted by those afraid to admit how easy it was to destroy a life without evidence. Months passed. The criminal case against Alina moved forward. She faced charges of obstruction, false reporting, perjury, and witness intimidation. Her attorney offered a plea deal, 5 years in exchange for a public admission. She refused. She went to trial. The jury deliberated less than 3 hours, guilty, on all counts. She was sentenced to 11 years, eligible for parole in 6. Ethan didn't attend the sentencing. He was working construction now, laying concrete for a sports center in Chicago. The job was grueling, humbling, but it was honest work. No lies, no cameras. When asked if he'd ever play football again, he said, "I used to dream of touchdowns. Now I just dream of quiet." But he did return to campus one last time. Mercer Valley invited him back to speak during orientation. They offered a public apology, long overdue, and renamed a student resource initiative in his honor, the Cross Foundation for Due Process and Truth in Justice. He walked to the podium, stared at the crowd. "I'm not here to tell you everyone who cries is lying. I'm here to tell you sometimes they are. And if we don't ask questions, if we just punish first and check facts later, then none of us are safe." He raised a hand. "You don't fight lies with rage. You fight them with truth, patient, relentless, undeniable." And with that, he walked off stage. No longer a cautionary tale, but a living testimony